This was the origin of the treasury that sort of stored up the revenues of the kingdom, as opposed to, distinct from, the personal income of the monarch. In other words, money that flowed to him as the king is different from money that flowed to him as a person who held certain lands and certain privileges. So the origins of the treasury was basically the person who looked after the king's personal possessions and gradually came to look after the wealth of England. The king had clerics who handled his correspondence and prepared formal documents for him. English kings from the 12th century on were routinely literate. They were irregularly literate before that. Gradually, some of these men became less personal servants of the king and more public officers of the realm, and thus was born the chancery, the writing office, and the record-keeping office of the English government. A royal government will move about from time to time. It goes about the country to show itself to the people, to check on local conditions. Well, there's a great transport officer in the royal house, the comes stabuli, the count of the stable, who becomes the constable. And gradually he becomes not merely the transport officer of the royal house, but in a way, its chief military and police officer. Well, we could go on and on and on like this, deriving the offices of state from the royal household. Basically, household government eventually became national government. Persons who served the king privately began to separate away from the king, sometimes, for example, in Westminster in London or in Paris, to settle down in permanent offices and there to do the business of the country. Now, in France, the question was really over what territories this system would extend. In other words, the expansion of household government to state government was true there, as it was in England. Initially, as I suggested, the French kings ruled not much more than Île-de-France. Slowly but surely, we have seen how the French kings, by defeating the English, by carrying out battles against religious dissenters in the south of France, began to extend their territorial reach. Now, one great advantage for France, first of all, is that in 987, a man, Hugh Capet, comes to the French throne, and his family reigns until 1328. 3.5 centuries by one family. Great stability. And that family, moreover, produced a saint, a very revered king, Louis IX. Reigned from 1226 to 1270, a long reign his, but a saint. A saint of the church, great prestige for the French monarchy. We'll see when we talk about Germany in our next lecture that this dynastic stability is a factor of real consequence, though the English didn't have it and did not fail for all of that. The innovation in the French system was that after lands had been conquered from the English, the French kings didn't assign them out to vassals as fiefs. They assigned them usually to members of the royal family in very large chunks called appanage. And these areas then were ruled over by an extension of royal government, sort of direct royal government was introduced into these territories, quite effective royal government in many ways, and the French kings didn't have to worry about a group of barons like those in England who forced King John to affix his signature to the Magna Carta. The French kings, in other words, used non-feudal policies, if we want to look at it this way, as soon as they were strong enough to do so. Now, the result of French policy was that royal government was stronger than England's because in England a significant local elite had existed and played key roles ever since Anglo-Saxon times. The French didn't permit that same kind of local elite to arise, but then France is larger. It is more ethnically complex. It is more socially complex. It is more economically complex. So it was less cohesive than England. So England and France were very different. But each had developed essentially the modern territorial limits of its state. Each had developed a reasonably effective central government. But this shows us two models of government. One, with a king increasingly checked and limited, or at least potentially checked and limited, by parliamentary institutions. Though again, we can say this because our hindsight is so clear. And another where it appears that the monarchy is working its way away from mediating institutions and from sharing power. But we ought not to assume, then, that either the French or the English model is normative for Europe as a whole. When we turn next time to Germany, to Iberia, to Italy, we'll see a number of very different models of political development. They have some things in common with England and France, and they differ as well. What we're going to see is complexity and richness in the political life of Europe. But perhaps these basic points on France and England will have helped us to launch that discussion, and we'll carry it forward in our next lecture.